Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Stroke FM. Today we have a real treat for you. We're going to be talking about the debriefing and the key lessons learned after a simulation session we had as a joint collaboration between our emergency department and our stroke colleagues. And this is a pertinent topic, and it is the topic of an airway problem, in this particular case, angioedema in the context of stroke. Now, this is an important topic, and we hope that you get some exciting lessons on this episode of Stroke FM. Okay, so I have some esteemed colleagues joining me today for today's episode. Let's go around and sort of tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Dr. Nicole Kester-Green. I'm a staff emergency physician, and I'm director of simulation for our department, our emergency department.
My name is Lowell Notario. I am the advanced practice nurse for an emergency department.
And my name is Miranda Lamb. I'm an interim clinical educator for an emergency department in Toronto, Ontario.
Welcome to you all. And I'm Human. I'm one of the stroke doctors at a Toronto hospital. So thank you so much for joining me today. I'm going to just lay out the case, and then we'll talk about how the scenario started and the key lessons we learned at every point. So the case was, it was a 67-year-old patient who presented to the emergency department with a full left MCA syndrome with right side of hemiplegia and aphasia. They had been last seen normal approximately 2 hours ago, and it was about 30 minutes from the time EMS had been called to the time they arrived in the emergency department. And it turns out that at our hospital, we have a great collaboration at our shop with our emergency department colleagues. And in this particular case, the emergency, in this scenario, the emergency physicians had already assessed the patient, discovered that it was a full left MCA syndrome. We even had a sense that the NIH was very high, upwards of 20, and a code stroke was activated. And for the context of this simulation, we did something pretty cool, which is we started off in the CT scanner. So when the participants came, we said, "You are in the CT scanner. This is an emerge department activated code stroke. And this is a patient who is 67 with a full left MCA syndrome." I'll tell you a few more pertinents, regular sort of past medical history stuff of hypertension, dyslipidemia, and diabetes, and some key medications: bisoprolol, metformin, Crestor, ramipril, no other allergies. And at this point, we said, "Okay, you are in the scanner." And we had a team of people join us for the simulation. And maybe, Miranda, you can kick us off about like who was there and how did the simulation start?
Sure. So the simulation started with our emergency colleagues, nurses in the CT scan room with the patient on a portable monitor with the scan going on. The team had been paged, the stroke team had been paged from the emergency department and arrived to meet the emergency nurses in the scanner. And this is where they initiated their handover to the team and shared the information that we had. One of the important parts of this is we didn't have the opportunity to pre-brief before the arrival of the stroke because it was called in the emergency department. But we did have the opportunity to do introductions because there's always time for introductions when teams arrive and you need to do a collaboration. So at this point, the everybody, you know, shared their names and their roles and what they knew about the situation at the time so that they could hand over to the stroke team.
And as that occurred, did you feel that how did the introductions go? And then tell us a little bit about what happened to the patient that kind of started us off into the spiral of all the other events.
So when the stroke team arrived at the CT scan, in the scan room was the emergency department monitoring the patient on the portable monitor. And at the time we had I believe it was the stroke fellow as well as two residents and a stroke nurse arrive simultaneously to the scan room. They had to introduce themselves to the emergency team and let them know, of course, that they were the stroke team and that they were there to assess the information that they already have. And then the emergency nurses were able to transfer the information over about the most recent set of vitals and how the patient had been tolerating the scan to that point.
So at this point, we showed them the CT scan and essentially it showed a plain CT with no hemorrhage. The aspect score was 7, so there were some early ischemic changes. And at this point, the stroke team made a decision to stop the scan so that plain CT was done, which is how, again, we do things as much as we can at our shop. The plain CT was stopped because it showed no hemorrhage. There were some early ischemic changes, but not sufficiently bad enough. The patient had a full stroke syndrome, so the stroke team then gave TPA before commencing with the rest of the scan. And then something happened.
Yes. So soon after the patient was given TPA, the patient had a change in their status. They became hypoxic. Their SATs went down into the low 90s. And it was noted that they also had some tongue and lip swelling. The stroke team was right on it. They immediately saw that there was a change in the patient's status and identified that perhaps if there was a reaction either to the contrast that was given or the TPA. And appropriately, they pulled the trigger on calling for the emergency physician to the CT scanner. So that happened quite quickly. And the emergency physician and the senior emergency resident arrived, and stroke immediately gave them the information that the patient had deteriorated and then appeared to be having a allergic reaction or a reaction to either the contrast or the TPA.
That's a pretty cool point. Yeah, exactly. As you said, there could have been a couple of causes here.
Right. And what is typical in eMERGE and, you know, what occurred at that stage was, rather than trying to hone in on the exact diagnosis, the senior eMERGE resident, who self-identified as the team leader, decided that he would treat the patient empirically with IM epinephrine. So that's pretty standard. Facial swelling, epinephrine. And I thought that was an appropriate decision. The other thing that occurred at that stage, almost simultaneously, was the senior resident asked the emergency staff physician if he could manage the airway. So he immediately offloaded that concern to the most experienced intubator in the room, which of course is very appropriate. At that stage, the decision had to be made about whether or not to continue with this patient in the scanner and manage this very critical situation, airway emergency, versus now moving to the emergency department resuscitation room and continuing to manage there. And that is a very critical decision and often a very difficult decision. And it revolves around, well, space and resources. Number one, do you have all of your tools available to you, and do you have the space that you need to potentially manage this difficult airway? And also, do you have the time to move now from the scanner to the emergency department resuscitation room? You know, the patient could very well even further deteriorate en route. Miranda, I'm curious if you felt that decision was made in an appropriate fashion, and if there could have been any other factors discussed at that stage.
Interesting that you brought that up, because during the simulation, the stroke nurse actually brought up very quickly that she was having trouble being heard. She felt that the anaphylaxis, or presumed to be anaphylaxis at the time, needed to be treated sooner, but she wasn't being heard. And then after that, the decision to be moved was made. So I think in time, I think it went well. Could it have gone better? It could always go a little bit better, but you need to try one before you get one perfect, I think.
I just want to go back to two amazing points you each raised. Miranda, you talked about how sometimes a person doesn't feel heard, and that can often be a problem in a resuscitation. And maybe you could tell us some strategies that you can think about how we can make the environment a bit better as far as, you know, pauses and debriefs. And then maybe Nicole can comment on something that she very nicely put out, which was the transition in the who was leading different aspects, and then how did that go? Because it went from stroke team being the code leader to then the emergency, essentially senior resident or fellow, and then the designation of the role change. So maybe, Miranda, what are some of the things that people can do in their shop, in their hospitals, to make sure that everyone's heard in a resuscitation? Are there some strategies that have come up from your perspective?
Well, I think the opportunity to do the introductions at the beginning of these scenarios is really important. Just knowing who you're working with is definitely key. Running these simulations obviously has tremendous value, just because if you play together, it's easier to work together. So I think that is definitely a key to it. The other thing is giving people space and time to be heard and using appropriate words to be recognized when you're trying to express a concern during a resuscitation like this. The nurse expressed in debrief later on that she felt her take home from this particular event was she just needed to feel allowed or to be able to speak up during these situations where she was concerned about patient safety or deterioration. And going forward, she just said, I would just speak up and make sure that I'm heard, direct it to the leader and go from there.
Lowell, I think you were going to make a comment about that, and then we'll Nicole can talk to us about how the transition went, and then we'll talk further about the management.
Yeah, so definitely agree with Miranda's comments about introductions and making sure that everybody knows who everyone else is in the room. And we talk about this all the time when we talk about crisis resource management skills. We call this concept role clarity, and making sure that everybody is aware of everybody else's role on the team and what everyone is capable of doing. Part of that concept of role clarity is being able to step in for others if they're unable to fulfill their task. For example, even from a nurse's perspective, if you have two nurses in the room, one of them is tasked with starting an IV, which is super critical to the workup of these patients. If they can't, if they miss the IV, or if the patient is particularly a hard poke, then being able to speak up and saying, hey, can someone take over? Can someone try an IV on this patient? I can't get it. Or escalating further up the chain to ensure that the person has appropriate vascular access. Part of the other concept that became very apparent, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, is making sure that everybody is on the same page. But I'll let Nicole talk about that.
So what I did notice is that Stroke did a great job of giving the initial handover and the initial information about what was the diagnosis and what treatments had the patient received. And the senior emergency resident self-established as the leader and assigned tasks. So he assigned the airway management task to the ED staff. The nurses were already engaged in their tasks, so they did not need to be assigned. And at that stage, Stroke took a little bit of a step back. And while they were engaged in starting some initial interventions and assessing the airway, I noticed that Stroke had a bit of a sideline discussion around what they felt could be going on with the patient. Was it the TPA? Was it a reaction to the contrast? And they had a very interesting discussion. However, the rest of the team was not privy to that discussion because they were very engaged and focused in their tasks. And this is something we see quite often when we have these ad hoc teams, is that the teams form into silos, and they are more comfortable obviously with their area of expertise, and they tend to share that information with the team members that they're familiar with and not share it with the entire team across the room, so that everybody can understand and have a detailed understanding of what's going on with the patient. And more often than not, there is some key bits of information that get lost. So again, we'll talk about this a little bit more, because this actually comes to play again later on in the case. But I wanted to start off by sort of drawing attention to that moment, because I think that was a key moment that we kind of will circle back to at the end of this discussion.
Yeah, exactly. In a case like this, there has to be a handoff of the acute resuscitation component to our emergency department colleagues, and how that's done and ensuring that we come back together to manage the patient is critical. So that's fantastic. Should we jump now to the transition back to the emergency department from the CT scanner, and some of the things that come to your mind as being important that the teams should be aware of in making sure that that destination is appropriate?
Definitely a key part of this is being out. Geography, it plays a small part in what we do because we can always run strokes in any location. We've done that in the past and we'll continue to do that in the future, I'm sure. But geography needs to be where you are and also where you're going. So we had this patient, obviously, in this particular scenario who was being stabilized and still needed airway management. And the decision was made to go back to the emergency department. But I think one of the misses that we had, or one of the things that we could have improved upon, was the communication back to the geography where we were headed to. So we were leaving the CT scan and heading back to our emergency department. And that required some communication with some players that were not in the CT scan room to confirm that we had a destination. Because of course you don't want to end up with an unstable patient or a patient with an airway compromise stuck in a hallway where you don't have the appropriate equipment that you can respond to their needs. So in this scenario, we needed to call back to the charge nurse in the emergency department to request a space to land so that we could proceed to intubation for this patient.
So that's a great segue to now the medical management. Nicole, I'm going to hand this off to you to talk about sort of some of the things that were discussed as far as the treatments. I'll just before that, I'll say that, you know, this is one of those feared complications of when we give TPA. Angioedema occurs, you know, not commonly, somewhere between 1-5% of cases. And as Nicole and you guys were just saying, sometimes it occurs because of the TPA, meaning that the TPA, usually in combination with an ACE inhibitor, in this particular case, the patient was on ramipril, can precipitate angioedema. And at other times, it could just be the good old-fashioned contrast. So what happened next, Nicole? Can you tell us a little bit about the dynamics of what you saw and also what you would say is the correct management in this case?
So just as you identified, Houman, that this is one of those feared cases, interestingly enough, the staff also said this is one of our most feared cases as an emergency physician. Angioedema, an airway emergency, this is one of those cases that you come across at least once in your career, maybe more than once, but it's the one that really sort of gets you more anxious than others. And so appropriately, when they arrived in the resuscitation room, they called for more epi, because obviously the initial IM dose of epi did not do the trick and the patient continued to be hypoxic. And standard empiric treatment for angioedema or a severe anaphylaxis would be methylprednisolone and Benadryl. So that was also called for and given. I think that was appropriate. If you're not certain about the exact etiology, you're going to use your full armamentarium of anaphylaxis drugs. And so those drugs are appropriate. As well, they clearly assessed that this patient had a difficult airway, was likely to have significant airway edema, and they called for anesthesia. And we always want to call for help in the emergency department. As physicians, we are very humble and we're not afraid to call for help when we think we could need it. And that helps ready all the resources that you could need in that situation. But of course, simulationist anesthesia was not available, and we asked the team that was there to manage the patient on their own. So an airway plan was discussed prior to anything getting started, and the decision was made to do awake intubation, meaning that the patient would be lightly sedated and intubated with a local anesthesia rather than a full RSI where the patient is actually induced and paralyzed. And that sort of leaves you the option of having to ventilate the patient should you be unsuccessful in intubating the patient. You never want to get into a situation where you can't intubate and you can't ventilate the patient, because the next step after that is going to be surgical airway. So the team decided to do an awake intubation, and they topicalized the patient with lidocaine and also called for ketamine to induce the patient. As well, they anticipated that perhaps because the patient already was quite sick, they would have phenylephrine ready to give if the patient became more hypotensive.
At this point, we observed an interesting interaction and a very thoughtful discussion between the senior emergency resident and the attending, who's also very experienced, by the way, in the sim, about the discussion of what to do with the IM doses of epinephrine that were being given versus doing an epinephrine infusion. And sort of we had some interesting thoughts on that.
Yeah, so, you know, the mantra that many of us learn in emergency medicine is that you never give intravenous epinephrine to a beating heart. In very basic terms. So what does that mean? Well, typically we use epi in a cardiac arrest situation if we're giving it IV. In the case of anaphylaxis, it's a tricky decision to give it IV. The patient is very, very sick. It's certainly a consideration, but there are some nuances. In this situation, the emergency department staff, who is one of our most senior physicians, felt that giving epinephrine was not indicated at that time, IV epinephrine, that is, because the patient was not hypotensive at that time. They were hypoxic, but they were not hypotensive. And so that decision was made for that reason. And the staff sort of superseded the resident and said, you know, I think we should just stick with the IM epinephrine for now and continue to monitor the patient's blood pressure closely.
Exactly. And by asking someone to go and think about making now an epi infusion, we also lose a team member and also the cognitive load that comes from that, aside from the fact that it's not indicated. And just for the trainees listening, Nicole, do you mind telling us kind of what doses you would use of the IM epi and the Benadryl and the methylpred?
Yeah, so the epi is, the concentration is always important. So with IM epi, the concentration is 1 to 1,000 and the dose is 0.5 milligrams. And repeated doses were given. And in this situation, it's appropriate to give repeated doses.
So you're saying that if there's an ongoing, as you're trying to manage the airway, you've given one dose of IM, you can go ahead and actually repeat that?
Yes, you might repeat it every 2 to 3 minutes.
And what about the prednisone dose? Just quick off, sort of just some numbers for our trainees to carry in their minds for the methylpred and the Benadryl.
So the methylprednisolone IV is 125 milligrams and the Benadryl 50 milligrams IV to start. Now that's one of those medications you can repeat as well. So the maximum dose you would give is 100 milligrams IV.
And people talk about ranitidine. What are your thoughts on that? It's neither here or there, probably, right? You can give some.
Yeah, I mean, ranitidine is an H2 blocker, so it does have some antihistamine value to it. And in this situation where you're kind of reaching for everything in your armamentarium, it is typical to give ranitidine, certainly at our facility. But I do know that there is some thought around that not being as important as the other medications that you're giving.
And just another fun fact is that, you know, sometimes these angioedema cases by TPA are more common in the non-dominant right MCA strokes, in which case here we gave the team a left MCA just to throw a wrench in there. Okay, so who wants to lead us into the next portion of what happened? So now they're, should we call the airway as managed at this point or not?
I think they managed the airway appropriately and they were successful in securing the tube. They confirmed that the patient was intubated and everybody took an audible sigh of relief at that stage.
The great parasympathetic sigh of relief. So at this point, by the way, Miranda was the person operating the mannequin. So Miranda was fixing all of the vitals and also making them worse. At this point, I think you started to normalize the vital signs and take us to the next step, right?
Yes, no, he started to stabilize, I believe. Nicole, you'd have to confirm on this. I wasn't able to take notes. I think we did give him some phenylephrine, or her, some phenylephrine as well, to stabilize the blood pressure at some point.
Yeah, I think the phenylephrine was given preemptively at the beginning, right when they were about to pass the tube, to avoid hypotension in that situation.
Yes, that's right. I remember the staff physician mentioning that the blood pressure was soft at the time, but not overly concerning. It has to be quite low for us to panic.
So at this point, somebody asks, should we continue the TPA and what do we do next? Thoughts on that?
Right. So that was another interesting discussion. And this kind of loops back to our earlier point. The ED physician at that point expressed surprise that the patient had actually received TPA and also inquired, oh, did the patient get contrast as well? And so the CT tech actually was the one who ended up triggering that discussion. And that's the very point that we were going back to about ad hoc teams working in silos, because stroke fully had a discussion around what was the etiology of this angioedema. However, during that discussion in the beginning, the ED staff was engaged in setting up and assessing the airway. And so that key bit of information was actually missed. And so this is something that we've seen time and time again when we're running these simulations with ad hoc teams and teams from different specialties and departments. And we've developed a remedy for this because it happens so often. It's almost like you need a bit of a force function or a tool that you have in your pocket that you can kind of pull out. And so what we've developed is what we call the pause and summary. And we have a catchy name for it, the Simply Commit, simple pauses for critical communication in teams. And it requires three pauses and summaries. The first pause is the initial summary where the team has just arrived and you're now giving all of the information about the patient's status and what the treatments have that the patient's received already. The second pause and summary is a summary of priorities. So now some initial interventions have occurred and you're recounting what's happened and deciding what are the next steps, what are the next priorities in care. And that midway summary is very, very important because that really gets all of the team on the same page and creates that shared mental model. And lastly is the pre-transfer summary. So this is before you go to another department, you're going to the scanner, you're going to ICU. You're now summarizing everything that's happened with the patient. What does the patient need to get to the next location? And what are the priorities once you get to that next location? And it's important that the whole team is paused. You could say, okay, team, let's take a timeout or let's pause here. Now I'm going to summarize. Those words are very important because that actually allows the entire team to have a discussion and make sure that everybody has the same information and has that shared mental model.
Lowell, any comments from your end just about the Simply Commit, this wonderful tool that you're using, and we're trying to also obviously in synergy, one of the key things is to try to work in synergy so that all protocols in the emergency department work well for all the teams that interact with the emergency department. Some comments there from you, Lowell, on this?
Yeah, absolutely. When we're talking about the shared mental model, it's very important that everybody is on the same page. And just based on the scenario that you all just heard, there are several points in this resuscitation where these pauses can benefit, right? From the moment that there is a change in patient condition to the moment that a critical decision has to be made about whether or not to intubate them, and more importantly along that line, how to intubate them, because an awake intubation is a very specific procedure. And depending on the context and the rest of the contributors to the situation, it's important that everybody is completely aware of the approach that we'll take, and as well as the backup and the contingency plans. That also brings up the point in CRM that we call leadership and followership. Traditionally, when we think of leadership, we think of one person kind of leading the charge and everybody just saying, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, I'll do whatever you say and I'll just follow. But it's important to recognize that as team members, we all have a responsibility to speak up and be an active member of that team and not just blindly following orders, but to also contribute in a positive sense to to the team and making sure that the person that is designated as the team leader is completely aware of all of the different happenings and different things that might be going on.
So before we wrap up, I'll just say that, as Nicole said very nicely, the TPA was stopped, and then a discussion occurred between the stroke team and the emergency department team of whether to take the patient back to the scanner. Because at this point, that we had TPA'd after knowing that the plain CT was okay. And therefore, after that juncture, what we had to know was whether you take the patient back to give them more contrast to complete the CT angiography. And what we decided was that the CT angiography was not necessary because we're going to give more contrast. We already knew that had a full left MCA syndrome. And the scenario sort of ended with saying, okay, now that we still know this patient has an M1 occlusion, we're not going to take him back to the scanner. They have a secure airway. Let's now involve our neurovascular colleagues and let's take this patient to the cath lab with anesthesia to get that clot out and actually provide definitive management. So that's kind of how we ended it. And that was one of those key steps we wanted at the end, that even after this, you know, very stressful, life-threatening situation, that we didn't, first of all, increase any additional harm to the patient by rescanning them, but also to address the underlying problem, which was they were having a big stroke and needed to go to the cath lab. So that's great. So any sort of final thoughts, take-home messages that you'd want to impart to the audience about lessons learned from the simulation and overall for their daily operations at their own centers?
I would say whenever you're running a assessing or trying to manage a very, very sick patient in the scanner, always strongly consider moving back to the emergency department and making that call to your charge nurse to ensure that you're going to the proper location. You never want to have to run an arrest in a hallway because you went to the wrong room by mistake. That's the first point I would make. The second point I would make is it's essential when you have ad hoc teams or teams that are unfamiliar with each other coming together that you actively make an effort to create that shared mental model and make sure that everybody is on the same page. So having a tool or having a force function at your fingertips that you use in those situations, like the one I mentioned, the pause and summary, simply commit, that is a way for you to ensure that everybody's getting the important information and the team can go forward in an effective manner.
I would reiterate a lot of what Nicole said, but in addition to that, I would also suggest that recognizing the value of each of your team members is invaluable, honestly. Having the ability to speak up and to listen to the other team members is critical in these responses. And we did see a lot of critical handover. We saw ED to stroke. We saw stroke to ICU. And we also managed to speak as well to radiology. So there were three or four teams involved by the time this scenario concluded. And each of those times required a discussion around what was going on with the patient and who was playing what role. So I think as well as just identifying those moments of concern and being able to speak up with the nurse, for example, that was concerned about the anaphylaxis not being treated, being able to speak up and hearing them speak up so that you could address those concerns. This was actually really well done.
Thanks so much for all those great points. And you know, my small contribution at this point would be to say that, you know, when the stroke team is handing over or asking for assistance back to the emergency department, whether it's speaking to obviously the charge nurse and also the emergency department staff or senior person there, like a fellow or a resident, that they need to come back, to use the right words to say that we have an airway emergency, so that everybody understands what's going on, instead of words like, oh, we have a sick patient in the scanner, we need to come back. The words matter, and that clear communication makes a huge difference in what everyone's mental model is now of what they're about to receive and how they're going to act. So that's fantastic. Alecta, thank you for your time and your expertise. It's been wonderful having you on the podcast, and I really hope that you can join us again. Thank you, and we will catch you next time on another episode of Stroke FM.